The coronavirus is not going away, so the globe is looking for better ways to test quickly.
Some of the tests will give you a result in as little as about 10 minutes, which is a real advance.
More tests equal fewer outbreaks. Also today, some young immigrants in the U.S. are fed up waiting for immigration reform.
When there are other countries that would willingly give me residency, I think that's what helped me get on that plane and leave everything behind.
And looted antiquities, buyer beware. In the 21st century, sales happen on Facebook. For years, archaeologists pressured the social media giant to clamp down.
Sale of looted antiquities from conflict zones may also mean that you are putting money in the pockets of would-be terrorists.
I'm Marco Werman. Those stories and more today here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. This is The World. It is good to be with you on this Friday. Coronavirus infections worldwide are spiking, approaching 200,000 new cases a day. The U.S. is recording its highest ever daily totals, about a fifth of the world's total. The nation's top infectious disease specialist, Dr. Anthony Fauci, addressed the situation today.
Remember, what happened in China affected us. What happened in Europe affected us. What's happening here is affecting others. We can't get away from that. It's interconnected.
Fauci said we all need to follow guidelines, especially younger people. Finding the positive note, Vice President Mike Pence said that we do know more than we did 2 months ago. Pence today talked about improvements that have been made during that time.
We exponentially scaled testing capacity, partnering with private sector, commercial laboratories. We've now reached some 30 million tests across the country, conducting some 500,000 tests a day.
Still, public health experts agree much more testing needs to be done. Most countries, including the U.S., just don't have enough tests available to really get a handle on the prevalence, spread, and contagiousness of the disease. Enter the Wild West of new tests that are being developed, some promising results in just minutes. There are a lot of these tests in the works, but how do we know if any of them are any good? We have two guests to talk about this. Rick Boddy is co-leader of the COVID-19 National Diagnostic Research and Evaluation Platform, known by its acronym CONDOR. It's based at the University of Manchester in England and is charged with evaluating all new so-called instant tests for use in the UK. Michael Minna joins us as well. He's an infectious disease specialist at Harvard's T.H. Chan School of Public Health. Minna also oversees lab testing for viruses at Brigham and Women's Hospital here in Boston and is advising companies that are working on rapid tests. Michael Minna, let me start with you. Instant tests for COVID, I mean, it's really tantalizing, but do they exist or is it too good to be true?
There actually are some that already exist. One particular one that comes to mind is the Abbott ID Now assay. It's a very rapid test. It can provide results very accurately within just 5 minutes. The problem is it's not widely available at this point, and it's a little bit expensive. So what we're really starting to see, R&D and new technology development puts us right on the cusp of a whole new class of tests, which are going to be very fast and very cheap to produce and manufacture and sell.
So, Rick Boddy, along with CONDOR, you're going to be evaluating these new rapid or instant tests. How quick are they promising to get back results, and how will you go about kind of determining their safety and efficacy?
Some of the tests will give you a result in as little as about 10 minutes. You don't need tests to be perfect. Some people would say that the only thing worse than having no test is a bad test. But actually, what we don't need is every test to be absolutely perfect.
And why not? Doesn't accurate data rely on as close to perfect as possible?
Yes, absolutely. As close to perfect as possible. Even the tests we're using right now are not completely perfect. What's really important to recognize is that we've got to get it as close to perfect for the purpose that we're using it as possible. So it may be, for example, that we're using this rapid test to direct people to an appropriate area of a hospital, and they'll still have a more accurate, definitive test. What we want to do, we have to direct people to an appropriate area of the hospital, so they're going to isolation rooms or general wards. But at the moment, what we're using is perhaps some judgment. You know, does it seem likely that this patient has COVID-19? And the new tests need to be better than what we have right now in order to do that. So they can still add some value if they're not perfect, so long as they're better than what we're already doing.
As you test them, you're still going to need some verification process. How do you build that in? How are you doing that with CONDOR?
Yeah, and that's a real challenge, actually. So with this national program we've set up, we've had to get a balance right. So normally when you introduce a diagnostic test into practice, you have to very carefully evaluate it. And that process can take a number of years. And we don't have years to spend on this. So we've got to do this in weeks for each new test. And that sets a whole new level of challenge, actually. So the important thing is what we've done in the UK is we've set up a coordinated infrastructure to deliver large trials across the country that will allow us to utilize the power of that broad network and deliver the research in much quicker time than we ordinarily would without compromising on the standards.
Michael Minna, what would you say is the value to people and epidemiologists of having an instant COVID test or fairly instant?
What we find is that for surveillance efforts, looking across the population and looking over the long term, if we can do a test more frequently and at a lower cost, and we can get the results turned around in minutes instead of a day, you have a much better chance actually at stopping outbreaks than using the gold standard test if it takes 24 hours to get results and you can only do it once a week because it's expensive. What we really need to be thinking about is what is the use case? And these rapid point of care tests, one of the use cases is to do surveillance. And so the sensitivity might not be per test, but it's really per populace. If you're doing the test every day, for example, then you can really relax your requirements on the sensitivity of each individual one, because as you test people day in and day out, you're bound to catch that virus when it starts growing enough to be able to transmit. So from a surveillance perspective, these fast, cheap tests can be extraordinarily beneficial. And I think that they could be what we really need to stop these outbreaks from spreading.
So, Rick Boddy, will you be testing the tests on people in hospitals or elderly care home settings in the UK, or are you going to start with animal testing?
We'll start with humans because that's much faster. We don't have the time to spend going through stages that might ordinarily have been gone through. But we'll be evaluating the new tests in a whole range of different settings. So in the UK, we have a system of testing centres where people in the community can go and get tested. Care homes represent a really important use case because we've had a lot of outbreaks in the care homes. So we'll be evaluating the tests in that environment. And throughout the hospital, there are multiple different use cases for the tests. So we'll be evaluating them in a whole range of different settings.
What are the risks? I mean, either of you could answer this. What are the risks of testing these tests on humans? I mean, especially in elder homes where, I mean, could this jeopardize people's health?
So what we'll be doing in the research is gathering the data, but not using it to influence any patient care until we know how accurate those tests are. So we'll be running the two tests side by side. All of the patients will get a reference method, and we will do what we're currently doing now, which is wait for those results until we make any clinical decisions. But we'll be gathering the data alongside that routine care. And then when we have enough data from enough patients to be confident about how the new tests are working, we'll feed back. And that will allow informed decisions to be made about which tests we'll start using in widespread clinical practice. So there really isn't any risk to the participants.
Michael Minna, you were talking earlier about point of care tests. Does that mean these would be used at hospitals, these instant tests, or possibly in a home environment?
There's a variety of different types of these rapid tests that can be used. But in general, the closer we can get the tests and the results to the patient or the individual getting screened, the better.
What about actually getting instant tests deployed to the entire globe? I mean, how difficult is that going to be?
It will be an enormous challenge, but it's why we have to have some new innovations. We're going to have different, I don't want to say classes of tests, but we might see some that are a little bit more raw. You might be able to print millions of them, for example, in one facility in a day and ship those out. That could actually expand across the globe.
Michael Minna is an infectious disease specialist at Harvard's T.H. Chan School of Public Health. Rick Boddy is co-leader of the Condor Project, which will evaluate all new instant or rapid COVID tests for use in the UK. Michael and Rick, thank you both very much.
Thanks so much. It's a pleasure to be here.
Thank you very much. It's a pleasure.
Not long ago, politicians in Arizona, Texas, Florida, and elsewhere moved forward to open up their economies and loosen emergency lockdown restrictions. Now they're hitting the brakes. This week, several U.S. states have seen record numbers of new daily COVID-19 infections. Latin America is facing a similar dilemma. Governments want to let businesses reopen, but in many parts of Latin America, the numbers of new coronavirus infections keeps rising. Politicians are dealing with a choice there, millions of people going without work or millions getting sick. The World's Jorge Valencia has this story about some independent scientists in Peru trying to do their part.
They're developing fast and cheap testing. They're studying how the virus is spreading across Peru. And they're figuring out a way to reduce the number of patients in hospitals.
Yeah, so my name is Teresa Ochoa. I'm a pediatric infectious disease specialist.
Dr. Ochoa directs the Tropical Medicine Institute at the Universidad Peruana Cayetano Heredia. I reached out at her home.
Here in Lima, Peru.
She's doing research to help the Peruvian Health Ministry. Along with the country's largest phone company, doctors at her university have created a program to automatically send text messages to people who've been to their hospital.
So the purpose of this small pilot study is actually to diagnose the patients earlier so they can have some proper care at home and not put on risk other people trying to go to the emergency room if they really don't need to go back.
Ochoa says they started the program 2 weeks ago, hoping it'll be an instrument that can help reduce overcrowding in hospitals across Peru.
And we're going to analyze it like in 1 more week on this. If this is working, the idea is then go to the Ministry of Health and escalate this project in a nationwide program.
That's just one of the projects. Dr. Pablo Sukuyama is a bacteriologist who works with Ochoa and usually studies microbacterial tuberculosis. Right now, he's studying how the coronavirus genome is evolving in his country, as have scientists in other countries.
So we felt like we should not lag behind this global effort. And
Sukuyama took my call at home, where he's also a dad.
Yes, that's my daughter. She's a year and a half.
Sukuyama explains that scientists studied the genomic sequence of the virus to trace how and where it has spread. This information is valuable for scientists developing a vaccine. Sukuyama says he's sequencing 1,000 genomes in all regions of Peru.
And these to see how it entered Peru sometime in March. And which lineages, which mutations are the ones that were most successful at spreading within different Peruvian regions.
Independent scientists in regions all over Latin America are figuring out ways to help. Dr. Valesca Callafa is an epidemiologist at the Federal University of Minas Gerais in Brazil. She says public health officials are overwhelmed.
Well, they are trying to take care of all those hospitalizations that are increasing very fast now in this phase of the epidemic here. And they are testing some special risk groups.
Like health professionals, grocery store workers, bus drivers. She says she is doing spatial analysis using the addresses of people who have been confirmed infected in her city of Belo Horizonte.
And so we can understand where people live and distribute over the city.
This is useful for public officials, but Dr. Teresa Ochoa in Lima, Peru, says that she wishes she could do more.
Yes, because I have colleagues that are working there. Many of them have got sick. So whatever we do is just nothing. It's a little bit comparing to what they're doing.
Ochoa says it hits close to home.
Sorry about that, but I get very emotional. I have a friend, a very close friend, that is the one in charge of managing the patients. And she keeps telling me that she goes home and keeps seeing all the dead people, no? O los cadáveres.
Ochoa says she's grateful for health workers treating patients because they are the ones taking the biggest risk. For The World, I'm Jorge Valencia.
You're with The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. The global war on terror is now coming up on 2 decades. It was launched by President George W. Bush's administration after the attacks on September 11th. This week, the State Department issued its annual Country Reports on Terrorism, a snapshot of key developments over the past year around the globe. Emma Rita Torres is the Director of Policy Research and Programs at the Soufan Center in New York. This annual report, in some ways, it's a threat assessment, right? So which terrorist groups is it focusing on?
So yes, the report is focused largely on Salafi jihadist groups like ISIS, the Islamic State, Al-Qaeda, and their affiliates. It also focuses quite a bit on Iran as a state sponsor of terror and the particular countries around the world that harbor terrorists from these groups. And it does have a new focus on white supremacy extremism, or what the State Department is calling REMT, or racially and ethnically motivated terrorism.
Right. And that's kind of a new thing in this report. What else is new? What struck you?
I think the main takeaway was the focus on ISIS as a resilient and adaptable group. Even though it lost its physical caliphate in Iraq and Syria, the group still continues to operate via new branches and networks. Al-Shabaab has retained a safe haven in Africa and de facto control over large parts of Somalia. In the Lake Chad region, ISIS West Africa is quite active, and terrorist attacks have increased significantly in the Sahel, around 250% since 2018.
So Iran identified in this report as supporting terror. What other countries were highlighted for having links to terrorist activities, not necessarily supporting terror?
The white supremacy piece is key here because over the last couple of years, the transnational white supremacist threat has grown. We've seen high profile attacks in 2019 in Christchurch, New Zealand, in Germany, in El Paso, Texas. And so they do recognize that the threat is rising and spreading geographically. The State Department did designate the Russian Imperial Movement, a white supremacist group, in April, which was an important step. And what it represents is really a shift in the mindset of U.S. government counterterrorism officials. But what we really want to see in reports moving forward is more in-depth analysis of the transnational threat of this movement, because there are global networks that exist around the world and they're sharing information in online spaces, Telegram, Discord, 4chan, 8chan, and that online space is turning to offline violence.
So, I mean, beyond financial pressure, how is the U.S. continuing to keep the pressure on this adaptable threat, especially if President Trump is determined to pull troops out of most of the trouble spots?
Yeah, I mean, it's a hard task to take up. I spent 10 years at the State Department, and I do think that there are strong efforts being made. But at the same time, the U.S. government has taken a backseat in Syria, where you have ISIS affiliates operating. And it's hard to see how the United States could have a strong position there when it has very little presence there. I think in Iraq, it's a better picture because the global coalition is present there. But again, as ISIS continues to, you know, go behind the scenes and plot, it's going to be much more difficult to seek them out. And with the resources squeezed as a result of COVID-19 and attention being elsewhere, I think the threat is only going to manifest and continue.
Emma Rita Torres, the Director of Policy Research and Programs at the Soufan Center, speaking with us from New York. Thank you very much for your time.
Thank you so much for having me.
During the pandemic, with many normal systems broken down, there's been a sudden risk that more people across the globe could fall prey to human traffickers. But another report, also from the U.S. State Department, sends a different message. Yesterday, Secretary of State Mike Pompeo released the annual U.S. report on human trafficking. It cites major progress, with 22 countries receiving improved rankings. As the world's Roopa Shenoy reports, those rankings have consequences that can help determine the flow of U.S. foreign aid.
This year marks 20 years since the U.S. first made an historic commitment to ending modern slavery by issuing an annual report. It ranks countries by their progress fighting human trafficking. Countries in the lowest category are restricted from receiving U.S. aid.
We've accomplished so much in the last 20 years.
John Richmond is U.S. Ambassador at Large to monitor and combat trafficking in persons. At this release of the 2020 report, he reminded the audience that President Trump had hosted a summit on human trafficking and issued an executive order to combat online child exploitation.
The department put this report out on time without any delays in the midst of a global pandemic, and that itself serves to show the priority this administration and the secretary has placed on this issue.
The report highlights enormous worldwide progress, giving many countries upgraded rankings.
Our engagement on this has made a difference. This report and the United States have made a positive difference.
But people who work on human trafficking say that positive message from the administration has come at the worst possible time. Martina Vandenberg is the founder and president of the Human Trafficking Legal Center.
At this moment, at the 20th anniversary, the State Department wants to tell a story of success and progress, and that's just not the story that the data tell.
Especially because right now, she says, the global pandemic is making more people vulnerable to human trafficking.
So what we're seeing around the globe is people going into greater debt, people now trapped in countries to which they have migrated, but completely unemployed. And the likelihood is that those people will be more vulnerable to indentured servitude and more vulnerable to forced labor when the world begins to open up again.
Vandenberg also takes issue with the U.S. giving itself the highest possible ranking in the report. Many advocates felt the U.S. deserved to be downgraded this year. Jean Brueggemann is executive director of Freedom Network USA. She says many of the president's border and immigration policies increase wait times and denials, putting more people at risk for trafficking, including vulnerable populations like LGBTQI people.
I do not think that the United States is engaged in sustained efforts The report tells you that when they say that they've maintained prosecution efforts at best, they've reduced efforts to provide protection, and the only prevention work they've done is federal agency training, which is not actually prevention. It's not actually changing the circumstances which puts people at risk.
As for other countries, Neha Mishra says the report's rankings have always been somewhat politicized, but this year's takes it to another level. Mishra is a specialist at the NGO, the Solidarity Center. She questions the upgraded ranking of Saudi Arabia in the report and says it may lead that country to do less to combat trafficking.
Even countries that don't get U.S. aid, reputationally, it meant a lot. It was embarrassing to be on tier three or the tier two watch list. And if the tier rankings don't mean anything, then that reputational pressure is gone.
For survivors who are now in the fight against human trafficking, the report is disheartening, says Suamir's Pirano Guzman. He was kidnapped in Honduras as a child and smuggled into the U.S. by human traffickers. President Obama appointed Pirano Guzman to the U.S. Advisory Council on Human Trafficking in 2015.
I'll be honest with you. I think we need to stop pretending that we're moving forward.
Because if the U.S. isn't honest about the reality of human trafficking, he says, it's not really serving the people who need help the most. For The World, I'm Rupa Shenoy.
You join us here on The World every weekday to hear stories that connect you to people and places around the globe. That connection continues on social media. Take a moment to share the stories that really resonate with you. Just click, read, listen, and share. You can find us on Twitter. We're at The World. Russian President Vladimir Putin published an essay this week about World War II, defending Stalin's non-aggression pact with Hitler.
Putin now wants to rewrite that piece of history and somehow imply that it was Poland's fault that Poland got invaded.
The revisionism isn't going over well in Warsaw. Also, a diplomatic spat over tea and coffee coming up on The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. We're a co-production of the BBC World Service, WGBH and PRX. For many immigrants, relief finally came last week when the Supreme Court ruled against the Trump administration's attempt to cancel the program known as DACA, Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals. It's helped protect hundreds of thousands of young immigrants from deportation. But as The World's Monica Campbell reports, living under DACA has forced many of them to make some agonizing decisions.
I connected with Nancy over Zoom, and on her wall, I spotted one of those world maps where you scratch off the places you've been to. Nancy's up to seven countries so far.
France, Belgium, I have Canada, I have the U.S., I have Togo, Ghana, Benin, and Nigeria.
She was born in Togo and arrived in the U.S. with her family when she was nine on tourist visas. When those visas expired, the threat of deportation was constant.
Every 3 months or so, we'd report to immigration. We'd let them know where we're at. And then at some point, I would literally get sick from having to go to immigration. I was scared. I would have nightmares.
Then Nancy qualified for DACA. She worried less about deportation, but her parents still face that threat every day. That's why she asked to use her first name only. But with DACA, Nancy could start her own legit consulting firm offering global data analysis. The UN is one of her main clients, and that's meant opportunities to travel internationally. But traveling with DACA isn't easy. If she leaves the country, there's always the risk she won't be let back in.
There's a ceiling with DACA that I always tell people, like, yes, you can work, but there's a ceiling. And that ceiling I wanted to shatter.
So 2 years ago, Nancy moved to Canada, Ontario. She has legal residency and a path to citizenship. She's traveled, too, scratching those countries off her map. She's also joined a global community of people who once had DACA, but have left the U.S. for more freedom.
I'm not spending my life waiting on the possibility of immigration reform when there are other countries that would willingly give me residency. I think that's what helped me get on that plane and leave everything behind.
It's a huge trade-off. By leaving DACA behind, it's possible she could be barred from returning to the U.S. for 10 years.
Leaving is not an easy decision.
Marayi Zamora returned to Mexico 2 years ago from North Carolina, where she lived since she was three. Her sister and her mom drove her to the airport.
And then my mom hugged me and she said, "I'm not crying. You're not leaving. I'm going to pretend that you're going on vacation and you're going to be back one day." So we all grew up with this. Just hold it in. We're not going to cry.
Zamora, who's 26 now, had DACA in the States. But once Trump was elected, nothing felt certain, especially when one of her siblings faced deportation. Zamora met with an immigration agent about it, and their conversation terrified her.
Throughout like our whole interaction, he basically told me like where I went to school, where I worked, what car I drove, where I lived, about my sister, my mom, like about everyone in my family. The anxiety that I already had like escalated, and I didn't want to deal with that anymore.
Zamora now lives with her husband in San Luis Potosí in central Mexico, a medium-sized city that doesn't feel too big or small. She's found work as an English teacher, which she did in the U.S., but it's been a rocky transition.
My first Thanksgiving, oh, it was a mess. Like, I FaceTimed my family, and while I was on FaceTime, I held it in. I didn't cry. But as soon as I hung up, the tears came down.
She's also documenting her life on YouTube. She calls it Diary of a Native Foreigner. In one video, she shows how she sometimes has to hike up to her building's rooftop to turn on the water for her apartment.
So, you know, we turn on the water pump to pump water, but we have to come upstairs to make sure that it's actually pumping.
It is.
Zamora's found tight-knit groups of people like her who grew up in the U.S. and returned to Mexico. And she's interviewing them one by one.
So let's start with your name. What's your name?
My name is Giovanni Diaz.
How old are you?
I am 28 years old.
All right. And when did you go to the States and where did you live?
I went to the United States when I was 8 years old and I crossed through Texas.
He talks about having DACA and being a manager at a McDonald's in Georgia, but he couldn't afford college because Georgia blocks in-state tuition for undocumented immigrants. So he went to study in Mexico. It's unclear how many people with DACA have left the U.S., but Maraí Zamora says it's important to keep track of one another, especially during the rough times.
There will be a period where you question everything, where you're depressed, where you're going to want to go back. So having this support system is super, super important.
That's Zamora's message to other people like her. Know that you're not alone. For the World, Monica Campbell.
A U.S. president does not typically meet with world leaders days before their national elections. But this week, President Trump welcomed Poland's President Andrzej Duda to the White House, even though Poland's election is this Sunday. From the Rose Garden, Trump did his best to give Duda a boost.
I do believe he has an election coming up, and I do believe he'll be very successful.
Author Ann Applebaum says from her vantage point in Warsaw, Duda's photo op with Trump might have gained him some points at home, or it might be a gamble that does not pay off.
Those in his party thought that this meeting would be a kind of slam dunk reason to vote for him, and they played it up as a great diplomatic success. Those who aren't going to vote for him thought it was a very strange thing for the American president to do. I mean, it was a kind of clear intervention in the election. There was no other purpose to the meeting. There was nothing achieved. There were no documents signed. It was a long trip to get a photograph.
Ann Applebaum, the two presidents have met 5 times, one-on-one in recent years, 3 times at the White House. How do you understand their alliance? What can they actually do for each other?
Trump's point of view, Duda is useful because he's one of the few European leaders who openly admires him and openly wants to be around him and be seen with him. Most of the others have now become pretty wary. From Duda's point of view, you know, look, I mean, the United States remains very popular in Poland. NATO is very popular. And so from Duda's point of view, it makes him seem like he's close to the United States. I mean, of course, this is incredibly risky from Duda's point of view because, you know, the next president, if it's not Trump, might feel very differently about Poland.
Duda has also been pushing for additional U.S. troops in Poland. He's offered to build a Fort Trump in Poland. And just this week, President Trump confirmed he has plans to move more than 9,000 U.S. forces out of Germany, sending some, not clear how many, to Poland. So if that does happen, what will be the upshot for NATO and security on Europe's eastern flank?
Everybody in Europe would like to see the U.S. commit more troops and be more present and so on. I mean, the disturbing piece of the story is that it seems as if Trump's reasoning for moving troops out of Germany isn't to do with security or to do with calculations about where those troops would best be placed. It seems like it's some kind of revenge against Angela Merkel, the German chancellor, who refused to come to Washington recently, saying that she didn't think the timing was good and it wasn't a good moment to have an international meeting in the middle of the pandemic.
So from the West, Trump talks about pulling out of NATO. In the East, President Vladimir Putin has been offering up a revised history lesson. Putin just published in a conservative magazine a 9,000-word essay on World War II defending the Soviet non-aggression pact with Hitler. He describes the occupation of Baltic states as with consent. How's that going over in Eastern Europe?
What he's referring to is the Hitler-Stalin pact. The two dictators actually divided Europe up between them. And so Hitler invaded Western Poland, the Soviet Union invaded Eastern Poland, and Putin now wants to rewrite that piece of history and somehow imply that it was Poland's fault that Poland got invaded and that it was somehow the Baltic states agreed to be invaded. There's no historical justification for it at all. Nobody's sure why it is that Putin has chosen to make this argument right now. I think it's part of a bigger effort that he's been making in recent years to rewrite the history of the 20th century in order to make the Soviet Union more heroic and to make our memories of it more heroic and triumphant.
Putin's essay was being pushed precisely during this week of the annual Victory Day parade in Moscow, which was postponed because of coronavirus. Is Putin in a position to celebrate great power status at this moment?
The kind of argument he's been making to the Russian people over the last several years is, okay, your wages are not going up, the economy is not great, there's a lot of corruption, but I am making Russia great again. I am restoring Russia, I'm putting her back in the center of world politics where she belongs, and you should keep me in power for that reason. But the point of your question is correct. Russia remains a very dangerous but medium-sized power. The Russian economy is weak, and it's weakened partly by low oil prices, but it's also weakened by really profound corruption and the very profound inequality as well, which has caused a lot of discontent. There have been, just under the radar, you know, on and off over the last couple of years, quite a lot of protests and a lot of dissent, not just in the big cities, not just in Moscow and St. Petersburg, but all over the country. And he's very anxious to damp that down.
I'm just curious, in Warsaw, is talk of this revisionist history making Poles at all nervous?
So whenever the Russians start to revise history, Russia's neighbors become nervous because Russia has used historical revisionism as an excuse to invade its neighbors in the past. Right now, it seems unlikely. It doesn't seem that Russia wants to pick a fight with the United States and with NATO at this exact moment. But, you know, we began this conversation by talking about the American president's weak commitment to NATO. Maybe this is something that Putin sees in the future he'll be able to take advantage of.
Author Anne Applebaum has a new book coming out soon. It's called Twilight of Democracy, The Seductive Allure of Authoritarianism. She joined us from just outside Warsaw. Anne, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Earlier today, Russian film and theater director Kirill Serebrennikov got his day in court. Serebrennikov is a big deal in Russia. Before he entered the courthouse, he was greeted by cheering admirers and colleagues. Inside the court, though, the atmosphere was very different. Serebrennikov was found guilty of embezzlement, a charge that many believe to be politically motivated. Reporter Charles Maines has been following the story closely and joins us now from Moscow. Before we get to the court's verdict from earlier today, Charles, tell us about this director, Kirill Serebrennikov. Is there a director or filmmaker you'd compare him to? And how did this whole court saga of his begin?
Yeah, I like how you're putting me on the spot right to start, Marco. he's kind of a mix. I mean, he might be someone like a Danny Boyle. He might be someone like a Sam Shepard comes to mind. I mean, he's one of Russia's most celebrated directors in theater, but also film. And that's why we talk about this crossover. Serebrennikov, he started the Gogol Center in 2012. It was one of the most innovative and groundbreaking theaters in Moscow, which has a good theater scene, by the way. Mm. And, you know, he was known then for pushing boundaries, which made this invitation that he got by the Ministry of Culture at the time, around 2011, to create a project called Platform, somewhat surprising. His taste looked more and more out of step with increasingly conservative Russia. And Serebrennikov was accused of embezzlement of nearly $2 million along with several colleagues in 2017. And the case has kind of ground through the courts ever since. Remarkably, the director never stopped working in prison and then later under house arrest. He continued to direct productions in Russia and Europe. And of course, today was the finale of this 3-year trial.
So you were at the court earlier today, Charles. What did you learn?
Well, he and his colleagues were all found guilty of being part of a criminal gang. The judge gave them all suspended sentences, but it really amounted to a win in Russian courts. Keep in mind that a not guilty verdict here is nearly unheard of. Over 99% conviction rates in criminal cases here, 99%. So afterwards, Serebrennikov said, you know, of course, he's not satisfied with the result. He was found guilty, but mostly he seemed worried about the coronavirus. Let's listen in for a moment.
So what's going on there, Charles? I mean, the atmosphere sounds pretty well.
Yeah, pretty happy people there. He's telling everyone to keep socially distancing, you know, don't get each other sick. We need to fight for the truth.
Outside the courthouse, it looked like from the video, there was a sizable showing of support.
Yeah, hundreds of people were out there all day long. Many of them were artists. There were a lot of journalists, several celebrities, including among those, a guy named Roma Zver. He's a rock musician with one of Russia's most popular rock bands, a group called Zveri. Now, Roma Zver also acted in a recent Serebrennikov-directed film called Leta, or Summer. And he said it really seemed that whatever happened today, this was before the ruling was out, even if it was a suspended sentence, the message was clear. There are really two camps in Russian culture. So here, Zver is saying that there's one group of artists who do exactly what authorities ask them to do, and then another group that are true to themselves, to their principles. And of course, one group goes to prison, the other group collects state awards and medals and all that. And that Russian contemporary culture was really, you know, fundamentally at war with itself.
So summarize for us, Charles, what you think Kirill Serebrennikov and this whole case represent.
Well, for sure, it represents that the justice system here will never admit it's wrong. Ironically, Serebrennikov was recruited to do this platform project to show off Russia's talents to the world. Instead, his prosecution in court seemed to kind of demonstrate the worst of Russia, you know, an artist being crushed by the state. But, you know, I go back to this conversation I had with Roma Zver. This is the rock musician who starred in Serebrennikov's last film called Leta, or Summer. You know, and it's about a Soviet underground rock scene in the 1980s. It's about these free spirits kind of struggling to find their place in conservative Soviet society. Лето, я изжарен, как котлета. Время есть, а денег нету. Well, you know, today it's the Russian Orthodox Church. It's Vladimir Putin instead of communist ideology dictating norms. But you just have to wonder how much has really changed.
Taking us out with a little Roma Zver, reporter Charles Maines in Moscow. Thanks very much for this.
Thank you. Я иду его искать.
A little bit of good news this week. Facebook has banned trading in antiquities. The social media platform had become one of the leading marketplaces for illegally looted ancient treasures. One of our favorite Syria experts, Amr Al-Azam, is an archaeologist by trade and has helped lead the four-year campaign to shut down this market. Azam teaches Middle Eastern history and anthropology at Shawnee State University in Portsmouth, Ohio. What kind of artifacts are we talking about here? Can you give us an example maybe from your own home of Syria?
Yes, of course. I mean, we've seen almost everything from little low value, I would call, bits of pottery, maybe a lamp, or maybe a small piece of glass. You know, these might be valued at $15, $20, even maybe $50, right up to, you know, extremely valuable mosaics and relief sculptures valued in the tens, if not hundreds of thousands of dollars. And all of this is found on sale on Facebook and other social media platforms.
And how obvious has it been on sale on Facebook? I mean, do you see kind of almost a gallery catalog with prices, that kind of thing?
Think of it this way. The same tools that you use on Facebook, those very same features that have become so normal and part of our daily lives, are exactly the perfect toolkit for a would-be trafficker, looter, or even criminal engaged in selling drugs or trading in other illicit materials.
So bring us up to date, Amr. What has Facebook now done exactly?
So what Facebook has done now is, as a result of the report that we produce and in consultation, I think, with other organizations, entities, including UNESCO and so on and so forth, they finally decided that they would now change their policy to ban the sale of all historical items or artifacts. And by historical artifacts, they have defined this, according to the information they gave us, products of archaeological discoveries, antiquities, funerary items, coins, tombstones, pharaonic material, mummified body parts, scrolls, manuscripts, etc. And so it's quite a wide ban, if you will, on the selling. And that in itself is a good step. It's a very good step. But the real problem for us is, how do you then police this? How do you, you know, it's going to be in the enforcement. How do you enforce this? And when we communicated with Facebook, they said that they would basically rely on self-reporting and they would rely on their AI, their artificial intelligence system in place. And we know that that does not work because we already have banned materials that are not supposed to be sold on Facebook according to their policy. That includes, you know, endangered wildlife, that includes guns, that includes drugs. And yet all of these are openly and easily available on Facebook. We're not talking about dark web here. We're talking about pages, personal, you know, or groups that are openly selling these items. And some of these groups have 150,000 members, 200,000 members, many of whom are actively engaged in buying and selling these goods.
Right. So is this move by Facebook enough? I mean, what more can be done, do you think?
What Facebook should do, it should recruit experts who know how to search for this kind of material and not simply rely on self-reporting. Facebook has known about this and has been warned about this since 2014, 2013 at the very least. And yet they've allowed this problem to grow to such an extent that now Facebook has this massive repository of material and information on its platform. And what they've decided to do is they want to delete everything. They do not intend to preserve any of this information. And that is the other big problem for us, because it's important from a historical perspective, and it's extremely important for any would-be trials for war crimes or in the future repatriations if these items should show up on the market and they need to be seized and then returned to their country of origin.
Right. I mean, that preservation, that inventory is crucial for just general tracking. Finally, for anyone listening who may have purchased such antiquities on Facebook, what is your plea to them right now?
My plea to them is to not do it again. I mean, if the deed is done, the deed is done. And to be very, very careful when you purchase any antiquities. If you are someone who does collect, who does buy antiquities, then make sure you do your due diligence. Don't just rely on the source to do it for you. And remember that trafficking today from conflict, you know, sale of looted antiquities from conflict zones like Syria, like Libya, like Yemen, may also mean that you are putting money in the pockets of would-be terrorists, extremists of all sorts.
Amar Al-Azam teaches Middle Eastern history and anthropology at Shawnee State University in Portsmouth, Ohio. Thank you very much. Always good to speak with you, Amar.
Thank you, Marco.
America's special relationship with Britain has been put to the test before, but nothing as consequential as this. It began with a video posted in May by the TikTok user known as Michelle from North Carolina.
Hey guys, so I get a lot of questions about hot tea, so today I wanted to show you what this American girl likes as hot tea.
Now, Britons take great pride in how they prepare their tea. So does Michelle from North Carolina.
So I mix a lot of ingredients together.
So first is 1 cup of Insta tea. 2 cups of Tang, Country Time lemonade, 1 cup of sugar, another cup of sugar.
A little tea with your sugar? The pushback? No, the rebellion was immediate. Some online comments calling this brew a war crime. But Michelle from North Carolina got back online.
Hey guys, so I got a lot of questions after my last video, and everyone wanted to see me make hot tea or British tea, so today we are going to make tea.
So far, so good.
So fill our mug with water. Put it in the microwave.
Stop. That was just too much for Brits to bear. Dame Karen Pierce, the British ambassador to Washington, could not hold back.
The Anglo-American relationship is defined by tea, and we've had a number of requests to show how to make a real cup of tea.
Pierce calls in the military, literally. A British Army soldier pops up on screen, decked out in full camo, brewing a cup in the field.
You don't need a microwave to make a cup of tea. All you need is a naked flame, tea bag, sugar.
Then Ambassador Pierce calls in the Royal Navy.
Not using a microwave, use a kettle.
And next, a pilot with the Royal Air Force in flight.
Making tea at altitude is complex.
as water boils at quite a different temperature.
The online tea war of 2020 then got a retaliatory strike. The U.S. ambassador in London, Woody Johnson, posted his own online video.
I'm going to make an American cup of coffee the way I do it every day.
His recipe, boiled water, instant coffee, milk. Yes, instant coffee. I got nowhere to go from here but home. TGIF. The World comes to you from the Nan and Bill Harris studio at WGBH in Boston. I'm Marco Werman. We're always with you online at theworld.org. Stay safe, be healthy, get caffeinated somehow. We're back with you on Monday.
From PRX.